I'm Al Filreis, and this is Poem Talk at the Writer's House, where I have the pleasure of convening three friends in the world of contemporary poetry and poetics to collaborate on a close but not too close reading of a poem. We'll talk, maybe even disagree a bit, and perhaps open up the verse to a few new possibilities, and we hope, gain for a poem that interests us some new readers and listeners. And I say listeners because Poem Talk poems are available in recordings made by the poets themselves as part of our PenSound archive, writing.upenn.edu/PenSound. Today, I'm joined here in Philadelphia at the Kelly Writer's House in our third floor garret studio by Kristen Gallagher, poet, teacher, critic, scholar, member of the faculty at LaGuardia Community College in New York, one of the founders of this very Kelly Writer's House back in 1995-96, editor and convener once of Rust Talks in Buffalo, editor of Handwritten Press Editions, who teaches a course called Teaching the City, among other topics, and writes, in addition to her poetry, articles on Freirean pedagogy and teaching writing in the new economy. And by Michael McGee, editor of Combo, once upon a time, a Kelly Writer's House mainstay in the 1990s, an original flarfist. Is it okay to call you an original flarfist? I'm not sure what original means in that context.
Yeah, I'll accept it.
All right. Author of brilliant homophonic translations such as Pledge, A Mishearing of the Pledge of Allegiance, and his well-known book, My Angie Dickinson, who engaged in what he called a perhaps ludicrous attempt to appropriate for flarf writing the term mainstream poetry, who has taught at the Rhode Island School of Design and who is now the co-founder and CEO of Rhode Island Mayoral Academies and Education Reform Group, and by Tracy Morris, in all her fabulousness, I had to say that word, fabulousness, multidisciplinary poet who has worked in theater, dance, music, film, known as a musical poet, has toured and performed worldwide, has presented widely on Black conceptual poetics, and on, quote, the deconstruction of standards in jazz that I had heard growing up, unquote, and whose great PenSound page includes, among many other fabulous cuts, those entitled My Great Grand Aunt Meets a Bush Supporter, so that's a great piece, Afrofuturism, and The Mrs. Gets Her Ass Kicked. Welcome back to the Writer's House, Tracy Morris.
Thank you. Great to be back, Al.
It's so good to see you, Michael.
Thanks, Al.
Back home, I feel.
And you too,
Kristen Gallagher.
Thank you.
This is like a reunion, I think.
Mike was my first poetry friend.
That's right.
That's great. Now you're sitting next to each other. Mm-hmm. And
gray hair.
Who has gray hair?
Well, not him.
I have no hair, which is a great way to avoid having
You got rid of
hair.
It as soon as it turned gray. We've all done stuff to make us gray. Well, we're here for a bunch of reasons, but one is to talk about a poem by Will Alexander entitled Compound Hibernation, which was performed at Berkeley in November 2006 and has since appeared in print in Alexander's book Compression and Purity, published by City Lights in 2011. So here now, we'll listen to Will Alexander performing Compound Hibernation.
Those who glance about me, who cease to see inside the sun, who cease to imagine its destabilized prequanta, cannot know me, cannot know my ethos as pumice, as mingled apparition or flare. My perception through the prior sun that I ingest like a blackened pre-existence or collected hawks through assignation. The sun with its dualisms, with its prebiotic photons which waver, perhaps nine suns before the sun existed, before the oceans seemed formed, there were molecular drafts, Akashic precursors, floating proto-ammonia. I think of carbon and wisp and floodings of feral combat shelter where black geometry accrues, before separable biology was born, before the contradictory ballast of de-existent protozoa, being scorching photon by abstentia like a pre-atomic sigil destabilized as blizzard, a precognitive rotation, a strange galvanics of the cosmos. And because of this galvanics, one reeks of invisible tremor walking around in league with daunting helium affliction. Thus, the mirrors in my skin like haunted salamander fluid, like cells bereft with cooling centigrade rotation. Therefore, I know the abyss as volatile lunar transposition, as subliminal mantis as climbing, as splintering. Therefore, I am not an oily or blasphemous yogin collapsing in default by sudden anger or water. Yet I am compound, struggling with scattered mental arrhythmia, with partial psychic aphasia, intensive, elusive, aloof by interior compounding.
So I'm going to be great if we just ramble all over this thing in and out of order, but I do want to use up my hostly prerogative to ask us to read, do a close reading of the first couple of lines to start with. So bear with me. Those who glance about me, who are they? I mean, those, are they other people? And see if you can help us locate where this is. Can we do this together, Mike? Where are we? What's going on?
Well, I had two reactions to the opening lines here. I mean, first, it seems like Alexander is trying to locate the speaker, in an otherworldly space.
Yeah.
So you have to think about, whether the speaker is inside the sun, as if that were possible.
Because there's some there's glancing and then there's seeing, and presumably he's sort of standing in that spot. And then there's a whole question of whether we know him. Tracy, your thoughts on the opening?
Yeah, it reminds me of a story. When Barack Obama first got elected when he won in 2008, a black male friend of mine says, the day after the election, I was walking down the street and a white woman saw me. I mean, she actually saw me. She looked in my eyes and she saw me. And we talked about this briefly, and he said that how often he is unseen by white women, that their eyes kind of glide past and around him. So that's this is sort of, and so this is the kind of classical Ellison sense, you
this
know?
This is an Ellisonian invisibility.
Absolutely.
Is that what you're saying?
And it's a form of magic, right? To make people disappear is a form of magic, right?
Can I interrupt for 1 second, because I want you to keep doing this?
Yeah,
but
no.
I just want to glance about me. The idiom glance about suggests two things. It suggests that they're not looking right at him, or they're getting that way.
That's right.
But it also glance about is also a kind of furtive look.
That's
glance
right.
about. So can you, does that help or hurt what you're trying to do?
That's why I'm thinking of it in this form of magic, because a lot of magic tricks of sleight of hand are about dispersing light, dispersing the ability to focus on what you're seeing and make you distracted by not seeing what is in front of you.
So there's a lot of lightness and darkness here. So,
so
we can only
around.
See what is lit. Oh,
exactly.
That's so interesting.
To Tracy's point too, it struck me that the title itself is probably an allusion, whether it's intentional or not, to Invisible Man. Then in the opening of Invisible Man, Ellison specifically connects hibernation and invisibility. So he describes hibernation as covert preparation for a more overt action.
And there's a whole lot of light in that basement, isn't there?
Right. Yeah, that's right.
Bulbs. Kristen, where are you?
I think I've been reading this really differently, but in part just because I think of Alexander as more of a surrealist and a kind of trance writer with a lot of spirituality, kind of almost a romantic spiritual writer, but without the subjectivization or the religion that romanticism and spirituality imply. So I think of these words as kind of coming out of a place where there's no stable subject at all, and there's
precognitive.
And there's so much science language. Those who glance about me, I'm almost picturing somebody kind of in a trance or in a very deeply meditative state with all the world, including themselves, at a kind of atomized level, bouncing around. So identity is really unclear. There's something kind of emergent here and unclear. It's destabilized pre-quanta that cannot know me.
So let me frame this and ask Tracy and Mike to add to this. In this poem and the ones that surround it, which he read all together at Berkeley, and then they became part of the book, we get a lot of subparticle physics, which we get here, astronomy, geography, alchemy, chemistry, and some political science. And all those vocabularies merge. And anybody who's ever written about Will Alexander talks about the importance of that. In this poem, there's he's looking back to a time before this, before that, before this, before that, a time of precognition, and he's associating it almost with the invention of the sun. So does that help? You know, Kristen's reading is he's seeking a process of composition that is precognitive, that's pre-skin, he says pre-skin, pre-color, pre-light. Does this help your reading of it, his, you know, knowing his interest in subparticle physics and that kind of thing? Mike, does this help?
Well, I mean, I like Kristen's idea that, you know, that this is not sort of merely about social invisibility, but that it's a kind of, it's a self-generated kind of invisibility that's more radical than that.
Why does he want to get back to pre-existence, to pre-creation?
Well, it's not just pre-existence in the line. It's like a blackened pre-existence, right? So once he, I mean, I hear what Kristen's saying, and I also feel that you, with the reference of the word blackened, you can't, it, and the notion of pre-existing, then I put this in the canon of a lot of Black people who talk about space as a site before racism, in which this, the actualization of Blackness is not predicated on whiteness. It's the it's predicated on primorality, on primalness, right? As, you know, Sekou Sundiata says in the Philosophy of the Cool poem, the Blackness begins, the Blackness ends. That's what he's talking about. Before light, there was space. Before, and that space was a blackened space.
So precognitive, precognition of what? Of the way bodies look, of the way bodies are constituted?
Before there was anything, there was Blackness. Before there was bodies, before there was microbial.
So the abyss is black.
Well, I thought about that. I think the abyss is black, but I think before nothing is that the totality is blackness. Blackness is not the absence. Blackness is the totality.
So how do we get from the seeming social, your Obama anecdote is, was heading in that direction, the social import of cannot know me, cannot know my ethos. How do we get from that to the science or the use of science vocabulary?
Because if it's reductive, if you reduce this black person to your fear as a white person, then you don't even know who you're seeing, because you're seeing before yourself. You're not seeing a photo negative of you. You're missing that you're seeing before you, before everything. There was me and you emerged from me. I'm not a reflection of you. That's how I saw it.
The sun with its dualisms, with its prebiotic photons which waver, perhaps nine suns before the sun existed, before the oceans seemed formed, there were molecular drafts, Akashic precursors, floating proto-ammonia. I think of carbon and wisps and floodings of feral combat shelter where black geometry accrues. Before separable biology was born, before the contradictory ballast of de-existent protozoa, being scorching photon by abstentia like a pre-atomic sigil destabilized as blizzard, a precognitive rotation, a strange galvanics of the cosmos.
At first I thought he was playing fast and loose with the science. He was mixing the, whatever it is, 4 or 5 billion years ago moment, right, of darkness into light, solar stuff, with the cognitive revolution, which is 70,000 years ago when human beings as a species were anatomically modern but not cognitively modern. And at that point, from what we can tell, we were all dark-skinned. So there's a way in which we go into the light and can be seen from 70,000 years ago, cognitive, equally from those billions of years ago into light. I began thinking he was playing fast and loose, but I think he's thinking all the way through it. And Kristen is giving me a look.
Well, it's just, it's hard because I do know, you know, he's also committed, I think, to surrealism and trance. So
you're trying to get us a little off being too denotative about the science.
Yeah, I am.
The intentionalism of the writing.
Right.
Right. So I think that But I do think all of that's there, right? Because it's his reading materials, it's his interests. We know that these things
are
there. We
know that he's reading about
this
stuff.
And they are coming, they're being shot through then in a way that's like being spoken through or musically.
So when you see a line
colliding,
before separable biology was born, what do you take that to mean?
I was interested in Akashic precursors, actually, because the word Akashic concerns, you know, the point at which, like, all knowledges of all systems can come together. And somehow I feel like that speaks to him and his mind and his process.
That's also
and
pre-separability.
Absolutely.
Isn't it?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, it's funny because I don't see this, anything that we're saying is non-surrealist in a way, because in order to get to this granular state that he is recalling, that he is invoking, I think he gets out of what's happening now. I think he gets beyond these kind of human relationships into an early dynamic. And one of the things, I mean, there's a lot of poems that come to mind which are comments, but it also made me think of Kubrick. Like how he, in 2001, he generates this hyper scientific, Stanley Kubrick, this hyper, you know, technological space, and in the end he goes back. It's a complete regression to the origins of things.
Yes.
Right? What does this big obelisk represent, the origin of things? But in order to get that, we have to go into the future to go. So that to me is a form of something that Al talked about in his Holocaust class, mediumship. Right.
Yeah, right.
We were talking about, I just want to state for the record that you and I were talking with students about genocide about an hour ago.
Yeah, it's intense class. That's still in my head. Yeah.
So what made you think of that? Can you say again?
Well, just that particular line that you were talking about in that book about Holocaust survivors and the him saying he is a medium. Like, I think you can't get to some of these stories, the painful aspect of these stories, and what went on before these stories, remember, you know, your upbringing, without becoming a medium to be able to recall it. I think in Sekou's poem, he says something like, zygote I was when I recalled it. So I think I'm thinking of that poem in the context of it. But I respect what you're saying in terms of it not being a reductive read to just say, well, it's about contemporary racism. It's like, he has to become a medium to talk about what's before that. Otherwise, he's still in the same state with that person who's glancing around him. And he's like, I'm in a state before that.
So maybe cannot know me is not a negative thing.
Well, I think it, I don't know.
Because of this idea of being a medium.
Well, Maybe so.
Maybe this is beyond subjectivity.
I thought about it in the context of other Black presentations of space as a haven for not having to think about the current conditions and how many people have done that. Sun Ra.
That's what Invisible is.
And that's where the word aloof.
Sun Ra all over this.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
The word aloof is interesting in that context, that the poem ends on this image, aloof by interior compounding.
Yes.
And aloof, usually we would think of that as having a negative connotation, as being snobby or whatever, but
there's also a feral combat shelter here.
Well, and it's aloof, it's the same root as aloft, right? So it's also just about getting above.
A precognitive rotation, a strange galvanics of the cosmos. And because of this galvanics, one reeks of invisible tremor, walking around in league with daunting helium affliction. Thus, the mirrors in my skin, like haunted salamander fluid, like cells bereft with cooling centigrade rotation. Therefore, I know the abyss as volatile lunar transposition, as subliminal mantis, as climbing, as splintering. Therefore, I am not an oily or blasphemous yogin, collapsing in default by sudden anger or water. Yet I am compound, struggling with scattered mental arrhythmia, with partial psychic aphasia, intensive, elusive, aloof by interior compounding.
Mike McGee, I picked this poem because, well, there's something about Poem Talk where you pick a poem to represent an entire poet's work, because we generally don't, we do a poet and then we go on. And I guess at some point we'll have to start repeating. So I try to find a poem that's short, that'll fit, but also a poem that is at least a little bit metapoetic, that's at least a little bit of an ars poetica. And I want to say what I think is the ars poetica quality of this, and then you can react. I mean, everybody can, but I want to start with you, Mike.
Sure.
So it struck me that Will Alexander is seeking, as an alternative to a contemporary poetics, And he's calling it a galvanics. He uses that word twice. This is not, he doesn't want a poetics, he wants a galvanics. If I'm right about that, or if that sounds good, would you talk about that?
I mean, I think of Will Alexander as a poet who is, you know, fairly hell-bent on not wanting to be pinned down as occupying one identity, either in his writing or in his personhood, while at the same time kind of not ignoring all of the kind of, you know, cultural energy around him that he feels very married to. So that's a complex trick to pull off.
Yes.
And so I like this idea of galvanics because it's sort of chemically produced electricity, right?
Right.
So
exactly.
So you're going inside to kind of the microscopic level
to find all the power.
Where you can see that even if some and it starts out with people looking at him, right? So on the one hand, if they're just looking at you, they're seeing the big you, and they're not seeing necessarily a very dynamic you or complex you. If you go microscopically, there's all kinds of stuff bouncing around, right? So
So
now all of a sudden you've got complexity and you've got one thing morphing into another and you've got all of the elements of creation. And that in a way is just a truer, more interesting place to be in. But it's no less you, right? So I think that's what seems to be fascinating to him.
Tracy, I like to think that the politics of being a black writer doing this have changed since Ellison tried to do it. The politics of saying, no, I don't want to be that, but I need to disappear, or I need to go somewhere else, I need to be unseen, that used to be automatically anti-left or, you know, anti-black identity. Is it a little easier for him, or does he face the same problems that Ellison and others have faced when they tried not to be pinned down?
I wonder about this pinning down and what he's trying to do. I think he wants to determine how he's pinned down. I don't even know if I want to use the word pinned or down, but I don't think, you know, I think he wants to determine where he's at. And I don't think he wants to make it clear because what I got from this poem, one of the things I liked about it, he doesn't feel obligated to be transparent. It's a genuflecting position to say, I want to make sure that you understand me. On the other hand, he's very specific temporally. You know, he's got all this stuff going on. And then he has, you know, in the second half of the poem, he's saying, and because, thus, therefore, therefore, yet I am. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's such a linear progression that he's saying, well, we can determine whether it's because it's space, right? So it could be up or down or whatever. But he's determining the narrative arc. He's not saying, I want to dispense with the whole notion. He's just saying, I get to decide what it is. And if you can't follow it, this is like Rakim and Follow the Leader, right? If you can't follow it, that's your problem. But I'm not obliged to walk down that path with you. It's your loss. That's what the first few lines mean to me. You don't see me, that's your loss.
No, that's fantastic. We could talk about this for hours and hours, but I just want to invite each of you to say one more thing that somehow didn't get into the conversation that you want to make sure is on the record. So, Mike, do you have a last thought on this?
Well, I remember, God, back in the late 90s, probably Harriet Mullen saying to me in an interview, talking about the kind of eccentric, nature of her work, saying it's dangerous to be the only one. So you try to figure out a way to be both inside and outside the circles. And I think this is a pretty canny poem in that way. I mean, there is a tradition that you can locate this within, including an African-American literary tradition that you can locate this work in. But it's also, you know, I also read it as a refusal to be permanently or centrally inside any one circle, social circle, literary circle, anything else. So, I mean, that's one of the takeaways for me about it. It's a very deft poem in that way.
Great. Thank you. Kristen Gallagher, final thought on this?
Sure. one of the things I was hoping to talk about was his work on Haiti and voodoo, mm-hmm. And thinking that possession is kind of another important model for thinking about how he's spoken through with words, and that has, a different kind of connection to identity, right? It's not the denotative declaration of an identity, but more like embracing a particular one strain of tradition through the African diaspora that is a way to get out of the subject, but it's a non-Western model of doing that, you know? So I think mm-hmm. that's interesting. And that automatic writing and chance and possession are all kind of a piece, you know? So modernism mm-hmm. and voodoo might have a lot more in common than we think.
Yep. Thank you. Tracy Morris.
Well, there's so much I want to... Oh, this made it so tempting, but I'm going to restrain myself because I know you said final thoughts. I just wanted, since we talked so much about the embodiment of organic compounds and all of that, I just wanted to make a note about his voice. The way that he reads this poem is that there's a topical, conversational, unaffected, sort of plaintive way that he presents this work, in which he's like sort of getting out of his way, his own way, and getting out of the way of these concepts, that very much evoked Etheridge Knight for me. This way in which he's making space through unaffected with this kind of dense writing is a really, really interesting compliment.
Fantastic. Thank you. My final thought, actually two little thoughts. One is, Surrealism, as I understand it, originated in the Freudian license to find things that we didn't really mean and see if they could come up from below, to use the Freudian metaphor. And another way to put this is precognitive. And I think that the fact that this poem has in the middle of it a precognitive rotation, a strange galvanics, suggests to me that the form of the poem is right there. The form that is the compositional form of the poem is right there in that surrealistic reach. The other point I want to make is simply that the final lines of the poem are, some of the finest lines of poetry that I've read in a long time. And that turn, if it were placed at the end of a Lowell poem or a Plath poem, would read similarly. There's a turn and then an I am statement. And I think Kristen is right that this is not your typical I am statement. But I am compound and then struggling with all these things. And I'm deeply affected. It's a very emotionally powerful thing to say after all this, that I am struggling with mental arrhythmia and partial psychic aphasia. And this poem is what you're going to get when bodies struggle in that way. Well, we like to end Poem Talk with a minute or two of Gathering Paradise, a chance for several of us, and if you're really brief, all of you, to spread wide our narrow hands to gather a little something really poetically good, to hail or commend someone or something going on in the poetry world. Who wants to gather some paradise?
Well, I'll just say, coming off of this poem, that if anyone out there who has not read them should read Nate Mackey's novels, the From a Broken Bottle, Traces of Perfume Still Emanate novels. They're very much, in my mind, related to this work, and they're essential reading, so I will recommend them.
Terrific. Thank you. Tracy?
Wow. Because of Mike's suggestion, I realized that this poem makes me think a lot about the Tales of Neverion series by Samuel R. Delaney.
Yeah, those are terrific.
Good suggestions. Kristen, can you top that?
I think the thing that springs to mind is a young writer who just moved to the Philadelphia area, who will be here for probably a while, named Aaron Winslow, who is writing a kind of cut up meta science fiction poetry, which is deeply hilarious and deeply disturbing, bodily disturbing. And if you don't know him yet and you're in Philly, he's been reading a little bit, and it's a good time. He's an amazing writer, and he doesn't have a book yet. I think somebody should publish him a book.
Great suggestion. And I'll just gather some paradise in remembering a wonderful series magazine that Mike McGee, our own Mike McGee here, published called Combo. And that is now available at Jacket 2, thanks to Danny Snelson's work of archiving. Well, that's all the blackened preexistence we have time for on Poem Talk today. Poem Talk at the Writer's House is a collaboration of the Center for Programs in Contemporary Writing and the Kelly Writer's House at the University of Pennsylvania and the Poetry Foundation, poetryfoundation.org. Thanks so much to my guests, Mike McGee, Kristen Gallagher, and Tracy Morris, and to Poem Talk's director and engineer today, Steve McLaughlin, and to our editor, as always, the self-same Steve McLaughlin. Next time on Poem Talk, Pierre Joris, Stacey Samazic, and Orchid Tierney join me to talk about Ann Waldman's open address to Senator Jesse Helms. This is Al Filreis, and I hope you'll join us again soon for that or another Poem Talk.